Tamim Ansari is an author and historian. His most recent book is The Invention of Yesterday, a 50,000-year history of human culture, conflict, and connection. This is Tamim Ansari. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right, I'm here with Tamim Ansari. Thank you very much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
So you come from a very interesting background. You were born in Kabul, but you were living, as I understand, kind of in sort of an Americanized part of the city. Is that right?
Well, I was born in Kabul. I was in Kabul till I was 8 or 9. Then my family went to Lashkargah, which is now the capital of the Taliban, essentially. You know, it's in the Southwest Desert, very conservative area. But America was busy doing some development projects there. Mm-hmm. And my father was posted there as official of the government. So we lived in Lashkargah for 6 years or so. Then we moved back to Kabul. So I've lived in different parts of Afghanistan.
Okay. And then...
Hang on a moment. It's not insignificant. Please. It's not insignificant that my mother was American.
Right.
And in fact, she was the first American to marry an Afghan and move there with him. So
in history?
In history, yeah.
Wow.
So you know, my life has been bicultural kind of from the start.
Well, that's kind of what I'm getting at, because you have this sort of ambidextrous quality where you can speak to both experiences. What age did you first come to America then?
I was 16.
Okay. And there's one of the more interesting experiences I heard you talk about at one point when you came to the States was a lot of the sort of weird cultural hiccups were related to romance. Like I think you talked about there was a girl who you at the time in high school you could have sworn was your girlfriend. But years later, you reconnected and turned out she was dating some other guy. And what was the whole story with that?
Well, you know, I don't want to go into that. Where did you see this? This wasn't in one of my books, was it?
No, it was in an interview you had done. Okay. You don't have to go into it if you don't want to. But I just thought it may speak to a larger sort of story of cultural differences.
Well, you know, I will say this. Yes, I came to the States and I went to a boarding school that gave me a scholarship. So basically, there was nothing like dating at that school.
Right.
Dating consisted of walking a girl home after school activities. I went to college. I didn't really know what dating was in college. I got out of college and I ended up in the counterculture. Believe me, there's no such thing as dating. There was no such thing as dating in the counterculture. Yes, I had girlfriends. You might call them girlfriends. I don't know. It wasn't right. Politically correct to call them girlfriends. But the relationships you had were with people you already knew, had known for a long time. There was no like, pick you up at 8.
Yeah.
So I was like 27 or 28 when I had the first encounter that you could really call a date when I moved to San Francisco.
At what point did you move to San Francisco and get involved in the counterculture then?
Well, I got involved in the counterculture right after I graduated from Reed College, which is in Portland.
Right.
And my 6 years of counterculture life was in Portland. You know, when I moved to San Francisco, for me, that was that represented joining the mainstream.
Really?
So that'll give you an indication of what Portland was like in that time.
Right.
But, you know, when I moved to San Francisco, I got a job with the Asia Foundation, which is a development quasi-governmental foundation that does development work. And it was, again, the first real job I'd had. And, you know, I was making a monthly income, so I was like a normal American.
Wait, so up to that point then, when you were in Portland and out of school, what was life like then? Like what occupied your, how did you sustain a living?
Well, you know, for money, for the most part, I was a waiter.
Okay.
And I worked like 3 days a week you know, and I had virtually no expenses, so I hardly needed money. I lived in big communal houses with lots of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is one of the things that's so striking about what's changed and what's going on in America. My rents there were like $15 a month.
That's you know, so crazy.
I was one of like 15 people that lived in a big house, but, you know, still, that's just like nothing.
Oh, my God.
I only bought used cars and used clothes. Yeah. I fixed my own car. And most of my time was occupied with something that you would call community activities. You know, okay. I worked for a newspaper where nobody was paid. And anybody who wanted to join was part of the newspaper. And so it was all activities like that.
That must have been an amazing time.
It was intense, and it was, for me anyhow, it was predicated on the idea that the world of industrial capitalism is not only collapsing, but probably has 4 or 5 years left. And so we got to get busy and build what's going to come after, because this will all be rubble soon. And, you know, when I left, it was because I was noticing that, you know what, this damn thing ain't collapsing.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, because I wasn't aware that that was the thinking of people at that time, too, because a lot of people my age have the same attitude that, you know, we're living in late capitalism and things are going to go down the tubes just any minute. So, you know, why, if you're going to get a job, why invest in your 401k? It's all going to go up in smoke anyway. All these things.
Yeah. You know, I think that's more true for you guys.
Right.
Part of what I thought, you know, what people like me thought back in the old Portland days was, why bother learning whatever our job skills in this society, because this society won't exist pretty soon. Why bother to learn to be an accountant or a lawyer or something? That's all part of a framework that's on its way out. Yeah. And, you know, now we're in a time of, and really that was actually just the beginning of what's happening now, because the pace of change is such that I think for you guys, it is a question of, what can I learn now that will not be obsolete?
Right.
By the time I've kind of learned it.
Yeah. And it, but even as you introduce that it becomes tricky to, how do you time these things? You know, you guys might've been right, but just wrong about the timing, you know?
Yeah.
Was that, did you experience any disillusionment when you looked around after 4 or 5 years and said, you know, things are still standing?
You know, it's always hard to separate one's observations of history and, you know, the public issues from what's going on privately. So, you know, my life in Portland was intertwined with the lives of many other people. Some of them could be described as girlfriends. So, you know, when I left Portland, there was disillusionment about just everything that I'd been involved with. And, you know, I don't know if I've said this someplace, you may have heard it, but I worked for this newspaper. I was, you know, quasi-editor of this paper. Different editors got special issues they were supposed to produce. I was going to produce one. I was on the roster for that. And I thought I'd go to LA and see if there were some real writing jobs there that actually paid money. And I jumped in my VW bug, and my car broke down in San Francisco. My car was always breaking down someplace. So I thought I'd just look around here to see if there was a job. And somebody said, you should try the Asia Foundation. And I was like, oh my God, the Asia Foundation had people stationed in Lashkargah when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I knew their kids. Sure, I'll go in. So I went to the Asia Foundation and I said, you guys have a job for me? I'm a writer. And they got all flustered and said, oh, well, usually people make an appointment, but as it happens, we're looking for an editor for our newspaper we publish called The Asian Student, but I'm sorry, it has to be someone from Asia. What could be better? I'm Afghan. Send me in. I'll talk to your. So I went in. I had an interview with some honcho at that, and I didn't think anything more about it because it was like a almost like a joke, you know. And I never made it to LA. I went back to Portland. 1 week later, they said, "All right, you're hired."
Yeah.
When do I start? They said next Monday. This was Thursday. And I packed up my car, gave up my apartment, sloughed off my issue of the paper, broke up with my girlfriend, and came to San Francisco.
Wow.
Started a new life. I was a different guy within 3 days.
There are a number of things were going through my mind as you were telling me that, yeah. But there are so many coincidences in that story that added up to a completely different life, you know, from 1 week to the next, as you described. One of the things I wanted to ask as you were saying that is, do you think that something like that is even possible today? I mean, never mind the fact that your rent was $15 an hour or $15 a month, but you walking into some NGO's offices and saying, "Hey, I want a job." And then just saying, "Oh, well, you know, why don't you just interview right now?" Like, that seems very foreign to my experience.
Well, no, I think that kind of stuff happens actually all the time.
Yeah.
You know, once in my writing of books for children, I wanted to do this series that I never actually did, but it was about people working on various aspects of the economy. So one thing I interviewed people about is, how did you get into this thing that you're doing? And they were all, you know, some of them were like, they founded the learning company, or some of them were various kinds of things. Without exception, they all got into what they were doing now through some series of coincidences. They were not doing whatever it was they went to school and studied. But, you know, I feel like more than any time before, actually, I think it's impossible to tell what the world would be like in 2 years. 2 years even seems like a long time.
Yeah.
Because the changes that are going on are, you know, they're on every front, and they're deeper in terms of things that have been around, have been taken for granted for decades, centuries, millennia, and ever since we became the species that we are. Those are all sort of on the table. So
it's a very uncertain time. Do you, speaking of stability, as we're, you know, last week, obviously the whole riot at the Capitol happened. And I think perhaps one of the things that we take for granted in the States is this notion of political stability. And I think that's part of the reason why people are more willing to play with it or treat it as though it's a frivolous thing when it's not. Being born in Afghanistan and seeing how the Afghanistan of your childhood, I imagine, does not exist right now.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
How do you receive these recent events and this whole idea of political stability?
I completely agree with you on the statement that here in America, we've taken broader framework of stability for granted. And I do think that's hanging in the balance now. And, you know, when I grew up in Afghanistan, there was a history we knew as our history, you know, and there was particular things that were very crucial moments. You know, there was like the first war against the British, and there was the War of Independence in 1920. And there was a number of turning point events like that. And shortly after 9/11, what hit me was how unaware we were that the most monumental event in our history as a country hadn't happened yet. It was about to happen, you know. And the, you know, for Afghanistan, actually, it started to happen 20 years earlier. The country had been destroyed in the course of 20 years. I was not there by then, you know, I was gone. During this pandemic, I'm rummaging through old papers, and I found a letter that my father had written me when things began to crumble in Afghanistan.
And he was living in there at the time?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was there and he died there. And so this letter, he wrote it when the king had just been overthrown by his cousin. So it wasn't quite, you know, it was actually just some squabbling within a dynastic family,
right.
But it was the beginning of the end. And he couldn't write to me about anything because in the old Afghanistan, you know, the dynasty, the royal monarchy was just so powerful. And it was a well-known thing that you didn't, in letters, you only said, the relatives are fine, you know,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah.
But this was a letter that somebody hand carried, you know, somebody that I knew went to Afghanistan, met my father, brought out this letter, and he talked about the things that were going on, and it was really scary. In a way, fortunately, shortly thereafter, when the coup overthrew the whole old Afghanistan, my father was still alive, but he was on his way out. He died shortly after that, about a year after that. But all my relatives came out over the course of the next few years. Those who could get out, got out.
Yeah.
And then over the next 20 years, oh my God, you know, it's like that, what was had been completely destroyed. Interesting thing is though, I finally went back after 9/11. You know, I was back there in 2002. Yeah, I think it was 2002.
Oh, wow.
And that was right after, or actually the U.S. war with the Taliban was still going on in the provinces. But it was the first time I'd gone back. And, you know, the you could drive around for 2 hours in the city of Kabul, never on the same street, and not see one single building that wasn't just rubble.
Wow.
It was astounding. And I went to the neighborhood that I lived in, and it took me a while to figure out which pile of rubble had been my house, and how I figured it out finally. Was we used to have a black alabaster shelf right above a fireplace in our living room. And the shattered remains of that shelf were still in a fragment of wall. And I saw that and I said, the black stone, there it is. But the interesting thing is that there was some sense in which the kind of the aura, the tone, the mood, the social atmosphere of Afghanistan, it was still that same Afghanistan, you know. I remember somebody was going to take me out to a village in the countryside where my ancestor had a shrine, and there was no traffic rules, regulations, or anything in Afghanistan, and so. You know, just this enormous traffic jam developed. You could stand on the top of your car and look in all directions. You couldn't see where it ended.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, we're never getting out of here. And I look around and nobody's pissed off. Nobody really cares. They're just gabbing with whoever is in the car next to them. That would never happen in L.A.
No.
There would be some fist fights. So that was the old Afghanistan. We went out to another village and sat by the stream. And pretty soon, like 10 or 20 people came drifting in And it's like, oh, who are you? Where are you? Oh, yeah, we just telling stories. And they brought baskets of mulberries, and time had no meaning. That was the old Afghanistan. But I went back 10 years later, after 10 years of intense development, and all the rubble was gone. There was high-rise buildings in its place. $1 trillion had dropped on this country. And it wasn't just physically changed. That sort of time has no meaning thing that was the old Afghanistan, that was gone.
Really?
Every place I looked, people were on the make. and it was a new country.
Okay, so there, again, a number of things popped out at me. The first one I wanted to ask is, what is that feeling like when you see your childhood home crushed to rubble?
Well, you know, for me, it's a ambiguous sensation, because until I finally settled down where I am now, and I'm married and I have two wonderful kids, and you know, this is my life, I never really was at home anywhere. So it's all just been a curiosity to me. Of course, it was devastating to see that it was disorienting. You know, when I lived in Lashkargah, about a mile down the river from our little town that had been built overnight by the government, about a mile down river from that, there was an ancient city that had been, it'd been destroyed 1,000 years earlier, but the walls and everything, they were still there. And that city looked like the place that I was a child, you know, 50 years earlier.
Yeah.
So that was weird. I went to the Kabul Museum. They had pedestals where the old art had stood, and they had put the rubble of the things the Taliban had destroyed on those pedestals with a photograph in front of it to show what used to be there.
Wow.
That was the museum. You know, but you know, in a sense, it was a story. And when I went back 10 years later, that was a story too, which I won't go into now.
Well, so the other thing I wanted to ask you about that, where you said the time has no meaning. And that reminds me, you know, people from Brazil sort of express the same thing, where they'll be in a line for, you know, to check out at the grocery store, and the person in front of them in line is just chatting to the cashier. And if you're Brazilian, that's just totally normal, and you pay no mind. But you know, Americans who have gone to live in Brazil, from what I've heard, have had that experience. And even if you have nowhere pressing to go, are looking at their watch like, okay, what's getting frustrated, or if a train gets delayed, all these kinds of things. And it speaks a little bit to a subject I want to talk about with you, the Industrial Revolution, where you started having people on, you know, in factories very much on the clock, and time having a lot of meaning and being divided up into precious minutes and seconds. Do you think part of the reason that the onset of this $1 trillion development in some ways caused that cultural shift, or how did that happen?
Well, there is an indisputable connection between the loss of that time has no meaning thing to where we are now, because without the technology that we have, there are certain things that are impossible to do. You know, and in old Afghanistan, there were no phones. So when people from the village came to visit, they couldn't tell you ahead of time that they were coming. You okay?
It's a little cough.
So they just arrived.
Yeah.
And when they did, you had to be ready to be the host to them. And when they came, They usually stayed for a week because, yeah, you know, they've come a long way. So I compare that to, I was going to meet my wife to see a movie, and the road was blocked, and I had to park my car, and I jumped on BART, and I thought I could make it, and something happened on BART, and all of this was, you know, half an hour's worth of trying to get to where my wife was, someplace else in San Francisco, within a minute of the scheduled time. That would be impossible in an older society. I think with, you know, like I talked about this in the invention of yesterday, when you have big industrial operations, it can't work unless everybody's there at the same time, you know, and you can't have people going for lunch and coming back when they feel like it. So the clock becomes the thing that everybody's inside of, instead of the clock being inside of everybody, if you see what I mean.
And that trust of strangers also feels very peculiar to me as an American, where I was in Bali at one point, and I was just walking down the road, and someone goes, where are you going? This Indonesian guy asked me that. And I was really caught off guard, because if someone said that to me in America, I would assume it was a cop or it was a guy trying to you know, do something. But he was literally just asking, where are you going? Like, oh, what's going on?
Yeah.
that might start an argument in the States. Yeah. How do people, especially when you said you went and visited there in 2002, I would be much more on edge about trusting strangers. How did that happen?
Well, you know, they weren't strangers all. I have relatives there still. And I stayed with a cousin. I have lots of cousins. And so that wasn't an issue. When I went back, I did have people to stay with, but I also stayed in a guest house, they're called, you know, sort of like little private hotels. And I actually had no trouble trusting strangers. You know, I felt like the violence that had visited Afghanistan was a different kind of violence than you experience here as part of the atmosphere of, you know, I felt like nobody was going to mug me.
Right.
But I might have, one of my friends there said, you know, he shrugged about danger, and he said, well, there, you know, as Osman Mifta, there's the danger that falls from the sky. You can't do anything about that. Other than that, life is just normal. When I was a kid, I used to go to school in Kabul. It's probably a half a mile away. I don't know what it was. To a kid, it seems like a very long distance. And I walked there. I went there by myself, first grade. You know, imagine that now. Just put your kid out in the street and say, all right, see you later. And my sister went to school that involved getting on a bus and then coming back on the bus. And sometimes she stopped at our grandmother's house on the way back. Nobody thought anything of it. Of course, she's going to get on the bus. Nobody's going to do anything to her. Why would anybody do something to some little girl? So that kind of violence I feel here. The other kind of violence, which is the violence that comes from the parts of society not meshing, and so there's, you know, social tension, ethnic friction, the potential of ideological violence. Most of my life here, that's just not been the case.
Yeah.
We were afraid of criminals, not of, you know, the other army. That's the thing that could be changing now.
Right. Yeah. Where the what happened at the Capitol could be the beginning of something rather than the end. And yeah. When you talked about what happened in the 1980s, where the king's cousin overthrew him. I at what point in the timeline is this relative to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan?
Well, that was about, that was 75.
Okay. Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, was it 73? I guess it was 73. So it was 5 years of this guy. And then the Communist Party of Afghanistan, which was a tiny little group, they overthrew him. So that was the end of the dynasty. You know, the family was gone. And now this little political party was in charge. 1 year later, the Soviets invaded. Mm. They were, you know, the little political party was basically the you know, the front scouts or whatever for the Soviet invasion. If they had managed to pacify the country, then maybe there wouldn't have been a Soviet invasion. And Afghanistan would have just become a Kazakhstan or something like that. Yeah. But the Communist Party of Afghanistan screwed it up. They couldn't do, you know, the country went up in flames. And so then the Soviets invaded. And that invasion happened in 1980.
What a horrible way to resolve, you know, oh, well, we want the communists to be in charge. They've bungled the job. So what's our alternative? Well, start bombing.
Like, yeah.
And was that sort of, you mentioned with the benefit of hindsight, the overthrow of the king by his cousin being sort of a beginning of the end. Was, could these issues have been fixed had the Soviet Union not invaded in 1980?
Well, you know, what if history is always hard to
sure
suss out, because you know, I think at the root of what happened in Afghanistan was something that is also at the root of what's happening in America. I call it, you know, I look at it as the urban-rural divide.
Yeah.
And rural Afghanistan was conservative and religious. Urban Afghanistan was in contact with the currents of the world. You know, it's like the people there spoke different languages, foreign languages. They went and came back to the country. And, you know, urban Afghanistan was pushing to modernize the social customs, which was a good thing. You know, they were this guy that overthrew his cousin was the person who succeeded in eliminating this chaudhari, this burqa thing from Afghan life. And he did it in an Afghan way. You know, he said, show me the Quran, show me where that says the burqa. And then all the scholars came and tried to show him, and it wasn't there because it isn't there. And he said, well, then the royal family is not going to do that anymore because we want to be good Muslims, and it doesn't say that there. Mm. He didn't say, tomorrow we're going to every village and tearing the veil off every woman. That's kind of what the communists said.
Yeah.
So, you know, they wanted to develop the country, and they were going to want to develop the country because, you know, the world is how it is, and Afghanistan, just there was no way it was going to stay
yeah.
a rural, conservative, old-fashioned Muslim country. The tension grew, and finally it just tore. There was also U.S. and the Soviet Union were in there struggling, trying to gain a little bit of advantage. And their way of struggling was to build things. So, you know, the United States came and built a road from Kabul to Kandahar, a really nice road. The Soviets said, we'll build a road over the mountains. They built one to the border of the Soviet Union. to Kabul, which proved to be very useful later. America said, we're going to build a huge international airport in Kandahar that is going to be able to land the biggest planes you've ever seen. Who is going to fly to Afghanistan with the biggest planes you've ever seen? Well, actually, it turns out the United States later, because the Kandahar International Airport, which can sustain heavy, you know, the big military planes. So all of these things were going on, and you can't have that kind of construction in a country without it spills over. You know, the rural people that are living in that area, they're going to be affected. If you're a person, you know, from some village who lives in this clan-like way, you know, whose life is all about social relationships, and that's the case for an Afghan, you know, especially in older times. So much of your time is spent with this cousin, that cousin, you know, keeping up with the family over in the village, the family in the other part of the city, the family here, the family there. So that's your life. But if you need a little money and this road is being built, well, you don't connect the two things. If there's a job there, you go get it.
Yeah.
You don't see that road is in conflict with you living the life that you're living right now. I thought about that when I went to Kabul one of those times, and you know, the hurry and the pollution, unbreathable air because the cars are just, there's so many. I don't think anybody in the world that I grew up in, that I left when I was 16, I don't think anybody would have traded that Afghanistan directly for this that was now.
Right.
But nobody had the choice. That wasn't ever on the table. It was always just, you know, somebody can have a car here. Should we have a car? Oh, are you kidding? Of course we want a car.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, and you talk about that in your book, Destiny Disrupted, where,
yeah.
And there's a couple questions I want to ask you about that. So that is, you know, the main starting point where people say, you know, the Industrial Revolution has started in Europe, and people say, yeah, well, you know, we want these goods. And it's not as though, you know, oh, we want to make our society exactly like that. Why is it that you can't have one without the other? You can't have the goods without the culture that surrounds it.
Well, there's many complicated ways to answer that, but I think culture is always, you know, there's no separating culture from the economy, for one thing, but more generally, you know, now I'm going to go into invention of yesterday a little bit.
Please.
Everybody, all human societies, all human people and the groups that they are, they have to somehow make their survival out of whatever environment they're in. They have to get the food they need from whatever they're in, and they have to repel the harm that is there. You know, if you're living in the Arctic, you have to find some way to stay warm. And culture is the way we interconnect so that we can do this communally as groups instead of just individually. And we're humans. We're always going to do that. That's how come we're such a successful species. We exist as bigger selves than our cultures. And these cultures do what they must to prosper as much as they can. It's never actually stable. No culture is actually stable. Every culture is always actually changing. More and more so, though, however, as the environment that we're dealing with is just what we've made. You know, yep. It's like very rarely are we actually just sitting by a river like I did in Afghanistan, eating mulberries. Yeah. Haven't done that since 2012. You know, it's like we hardly touch anything that isn't us. So anything we do to deal with the environment actually changes the environment, which gives us new things that we have to deal with because we caused it, but now it's just as if that's the environment. Climate change is one of those, you know? So the thing about the Industrial Revolution and everything that surrounded it in Europe is that it's a very efficient way to produce goods. And capitalism is part of that too. You know, it's like as soon as there was something invented in Europe, there was a social structure where somebody could find a way to make money off that thing.
Yeah.
As soon as somebody could, there was money to be made in improving that thing. So the technology itself drove itself forward into improvement. When you look at a society that emphasis is on how to achieve social harmony, like Islamic societies, that's basically what the goal is. It's not the reality, but that's the preoccupation. Well, you know, you're not going to waste time inventing a car because that takes time. And it means you have to leave the circle and people will go on with their storytelling without you. When you come back, they won't remember who you are. You know, it's like you want to stay with the group.
Yeah.
So the car won't be invented there, but if someone invents it, those people will want the car if they can get it. So, so it's like a recursive process.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you talk about the inventions, because as you point out, and something that I didn't realize is that the steam engine was invented in the Islamic world before it was in Europe. The difference was that people, you know, it wasn't just as you, I forget exactly how you phrase it, but it's not just necessity is the mother of invention. You can have the invention, but you have to want to use it in a particular way.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know,
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, please.
Well, you know, the thing you're thinking about, it was mechanical, you know, self-driving machines. It was, they didn't use steam, but they were able to use various methods to create with gears and clockwork engines and machinery that could do stuff. Right. But they didn't have any particular economic productive use for it because they were producing plenty. And the production that they had in the Islamic world while the Industrial Revolution was going on was virtually all small workshop kind of productions. And what made the society very rich is that they had immense, you know, administrative machinery, actually a lot, for facilitating trade so that handicrafts in Morocco were easily able to reach India or Kazakhstan or, you know, any place else. So the Islamic world had at its disposal, people anywhere had it at their disposal, the goods that were being made by anybody, any place else in the world. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but right. That's the pattern. When you have a country like Europe or a place like Europe, it's not actually a country, I guess, and less so now than it was
right.
3 years ago. but in Europe, this private ownership of the means of production, not to get all Marxist on you, but
sure.
still, you know, sure. that's the thing. If somebody can own that machine, they have incentive to, you know, to produce as many of the machines as possible so they can make as many of these goods as possible so they can sell it as cheap as possible. And, you know, that they have as many customers as possible. But then all those people who are creating, you're making cloth and stuff in their little room behind the kitchen or whatever, they can't keep up with that. They're wiped out. There was something else I was going to say about that, but I've forgotten what it was.
That's okay. If it comes to you, feel free to interrupt. But one of the questions I wanted to ask there then was the fact that you've written about how the early success of Islam, a lot of it was predicated on the fact that this group of Muslims were winning battles that seemingly they had no business winning. And so people yeah. concluded, okay, well, clearly they must really have God on their side. And, yeah. you know, these Islamic empires as they rose and fell, when they would fall, people would have to turn around and say, okay, what have we done to lose God's favor? And that kind of became, that question recurred after the Industrial Revolution, where the West was now in ascendance. Are people in the Islamic world still trying to answer that question, I suppose?
I think it's gotten more complicated. You know, we're not in the early stages of the imperialist adventure, with the West and the Islamic world. And that's partly because, you know, the West is starting to lose its steam, and something is shifting globally. So we'll have to wait to see what that is. The Islamic world is not prospering, though, right now. The social breakdown is pretty intense, and the narrative that until recently, I don't know what's going on now, you know, but the jihadist energy in the Islamic world, as represented, let's say, by Al-Qaeda first, but then the Taliban, and then ISIS, and who knows what now, Boko Haram, probably, all of those guys, you know, they are using a narrative to, you know, to secure power, to have power in the society. And the narrative that they're looking at is a reversion to the narrative that is kind of the original root of the Islamic narrative, which is there was a small group and God came to them and said, this is what you have to do in order to be successful. If you follow these instructions from God, nobody can win a war against you. But the trouble is, it won't work unless you actually follow those directions exactly. So the narrative that these jihadists are preaching is what's gone wrong is that we're not following the directions exactly. We have to go back to the beginning and see exactly what they said. And, you know, there's many shades of opinion in the Islamic world. And there are many different ways to dip into that early history of Islam and many different narratives that you could derive from it. For example, you know, the three enormously important figures in the foundational Islamic narrative are Khadija, who was the Prophet's wife, his first convert, so to speak. I mean, she was the first one who heard what he had to say and said, "You're right. I'm following you, dude." She was his boss. She was a you know, well-to-do businesswoman. She hired him as her, you know, manager of her caravans. Then they got married. So Khadija was important. And there was Fatima and there was Aisha. And Aisha was, among other things, a warrior. She led big armies. And later, when she lost those battles and she was retired to her home, she became an important scholar in Islam, gathering hadith, which are sayings and traditions of the Prophet. So one could look at that and say, well, the Islamic you know, tradition is one that sees bigger roles and more, you know, rights secured for women. The literalist interpretation of those narratives and that scripture would say, no, this is how it was then, this is how it has to be now. And, you know, the difference would be if you were to say that what you derive from Islam is not literally the scripture, but the example that was given by the scriptural, you know, by those who followed scripture then in response to their circumstances. You should look for the deep principles that are demonstrated by this response those people had then. For example, you know, Islamic law sets down when somebody dies, who inherits what and how much. And the inheritance of women is specified, and the inheritance of daughters is specified, and the inheritance of sons and all these different relatives. And women get less. But you know, there was at that time no legal code that allowed any inheritance for women. You know, that was a huge thing.
Yeah.
When Muhammad went to Medina, he, you know, they set up a system in which everybody, whatever their religion, could do their thing. Nobody had to be a Muslim. It's only if the whole city was attacked, the Muslims were in charge of repelling the attack, and everybody, no matter what their religion, had to jump in and help. Well, you could look at that and say that was a foundational source for diversity and tolerance. There's right. even a Quranic verse that says something pretty much like that. It's like, they have their way, you have your way, don't worry about it. Relax, kid.
Yeah.
So that's there. But Islamic, the unfolding of Islamic tradition, the way it happened, somehow had built into it a deeply conservative impulse, which was to, from the start to try to recover exactly what Muhammad said and did, and to treat that as a blueprint for how people should live rather than as a guideline for how people should decide to live. So in Islam, reformist movements never say, you know, some, I won't say never, but they tend not to say, well, that was good for that time, but now we need to adapt to these new times and let's see how we can. It's always, we've gone wrong, let's find out where we went wrong and go back. When scholars in the modernist Muslim movement in Egypt began to look for sources in the Quran and in Islamic tradition that would, that would counter what conservative Muslims were saying about the roles of women, they didn't say, oh, that was then, we have to do something new. They said, no, you guys have misinterpreted. We'll go back and find the scriptures and we'll show you that it never said that.
Yeah.
So that's just a different way of going about things. Now, these last 20 years or so have been so ruthless to Islamic societies. You know, the refugee tide that has come out of parts of the Islamic world have been destructive to Muslim societies. They have been symptoms of the destruction of Muslim societies, and they've been difficult to absorb for Western societies. So this movement of people has been a difficult thing for history now. On the other hand, it mixes everybody up. Everybody's hearing each other's stories. No doubt at first, everybody will say, you're wrong, that's bullshit, I'm gonna kill you.
Yeah.
but eventually, it might be that people will say, well, you're right about some things, but you're not about some other things. I'll give you one example of something that could happen. You know, jihad is such a term that is so frequent. There's a meaning to it that everybody feels with a shiver now when they hear it. Jihad, that means kill the infidel. I think there's, you know, it's understood that way a lot in the Muslim world as it is in the as it is in the West. But jihad is only actually used twice in the Quran, and it derives from something, from a word that means struggle. And so liberal Muslims like to say, oh, jihad means the struggle to be good. That's what you're supposed to be struggling to do. But I've looked at it and something else has occurred to me, because, you know, the famous five pillars of Islam are: you agree that there's only one God, you pray five times a day, you give 2% of your wealth to charity, you go to Mecca once in a lifetime if you can, and you fast during a certain month. Well, Islam is so community-oriented that it's puzzling to see that, because you have to ask, where in those five pillars is some duty to the community? Charity is something you do personally. That's where I suddenly realized jihad comes in. If it means struggle, I am always hearing progressives say, the struggle for social justice. Struggle is like a common coin in the world that I've been in, you know, the change the world for the good progressive movements world. And I think that would be a way that it could be interpreted in Islam.
Mm. Interesting. So it, in other words, and that does not necessarily, does that place limits on whether or not it can be violent, or much like, you know, the progressive social movements are, you know, basically nonviolent, but also if, you know, like the protests and uprisings of this past summer sometimes turn violent. I guess what I'm asking is there a clear prohibition on violence within jihad?
There's not a clear prohibition on violence within Islam. There isn't. Right. That's something that Muslims have to cop to. It's not about violent protests, though. It's about defending your community when it's under attack. That's, you know, you can be violent then. You have the right. But when I look at jihad and struggle, that's not what I'm thinking about. What I'm thinking about is that it's not enough to be charitable on a personal basis to individuals who are poor and suffering. It's also important to work to build institutions that will make society be a just place. You know, so that's a different, there's nowhere in the five pillars that it talks about that, but it's so much in the spirit of Islam that I'm like, oh, that's where it is. Kind of was hiding out.
And when people ask these questions within the Islamic world of, you know, okay, why are we, why have we quote unquote gone astray, or why are we, is our society suffering or stagnating? You know, how have, you know, at what point do we have to go back to in order to revive the true spirit of Islam? I guess coming from a, you know, at least ostensibly a secular democratic country, seeing questions about the way your society should move, being framed in that religious way, I know that I would be, if that was how politics was framed in the United States, I would be very uncomfortable with that. Is there a way past that? I mean, there have been secular democracies within the Islamic world, but it seems like that's not really the direction it's going now.
No, you could bring up Turkey on that score, you know?
Right.
Turkey was the secular democratic country, although the democracy was held in place by the military. That's the case in Turkey, but it's gone the other way now. It's an Islamist country more. I don't know. You know, I'm a secular guy myself, so I want to see that prosper here. But I think there's a danger that, I think the insurrection coup attempt or whatever it is in DC is fueled by a Christian version of Talibanism. This guy, Josh Hawley, I don't know if you've looked into what he believes, but he believes white Christians should rule the country and eventually the nation.
Yeah.
So I would be very uncomfortable with that, like I hope you would.
Yes, yeah, definitely. Do you see then, you mentioned it was a form of Talibanism. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Like, where do you see the parallels?
The parallels I see is the Taliban said, we know what God said the society should be living like, and we will use whatever we will make that the law of the land, the religious law by which we live. We're going to make that the law of the land. Since they had untrammeled power, they were able to enforce that to such an extent that they had total control of the country, and they did carry out most of their transformations. I think if a white supremacist Christian patriotic militia group, that's an entity, that's not just a description or a bunch of adjectives,
right?
That movement exists in America. If they were able to have the same kind of total power that the Taliban had in Afghanistan, I think all of us would find ourselves doing things that we don't do now.
Yeah,
I won't go any further than that. I just said, saying, they would have to believe certain things or not say they didn't. If they didn't, they'd have to go to church a lot.
Do you think that there's a path forward? I guess let's focus on Afghanistan. Do you think there's a path forward out of the current quagmire? Do you think there's a way to establish a democratic, stable country there? Or do you think that this, especially the United States military adventure there, which has gone on for about 20 years, do you think that that is... I guess what my question should be is, the presence of the United States in Afghanistan is often justified as saying, well, if we leave, stability will erode, the Taliban will take back over. And yet, I think most Americans want us to leave Afghanistan. Is there a way that we can leave and for there, to leave a democracy in place?
I think when America leaves, there's going to be some bad stuff happening in Afghanistan. I don't think it's reasonable to suppose that America could stay in Afghanistan indefinitely.
Right.
So it will leave at some point. Part of that doesn't have to do with Afghanistan. I think the ability of the U.S. to project military power around the world is starting to erode. And it isn't going to be worth it to America to be in Afghanistan. I think that America has vital military reasons to be in Afghanistan. It has those three big air bases. Afghanistan has always been this place from which other sorts of global politics things could be shifted or manipulated. So in Afghanistan, if you have big air bases in those three places, Kabul, Kandahar, and up in the north, you can reach Beijing, you can reach Moscow, you can reach Delhi, you can reach Tehran. That's, as long as you're a player in global power politics, you will not readily give up those air bases. So yeah. I think, down at the core, that's a factor. Can Afghanistan work out its difficulties and become one country again? It's really the same question as here. Can all of us start to become just Americans again?
Right.
The word that I balk at there is stable, because there are times when things are stable and there are times when things are not, but there are not times when we've finally gotten there and this is the way things are. It's always changing.
Yeah.
And when it changes, not everything changes at the same pace or in the same way. So pretty soon, whatever seems stable starts to pull on itself because it's shifting in different directions at once. And, you know, at some level, we got to do that. We have to keep changing because reality doesn't sit still. So that's the human condition.
That is a good note to end it on.
All right.
Look, thank you very much for your time. Is there anything you want to plug or get off your chest before we go here? No.
I wrote a book called Invention yesterday. It was published last year. Go buy it.
There you go. All right. Thanks so much for your time. Thank
you. Bye.
Take care.
Thank you to Tamim Ansari, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.